The Friday edition of the Large Morning Show in the afternoon on the Big 550 KTRS. I am Paul Harris. Ian Geis and Dan Strauss are here with me, and Colin Jeffrey now switches from his news director mode into showbiz boy mode for the showbiz segment of the show. Hello, Colin. How are you today?
Doing well. How are you, Paul?
I'm happy to be in air conditioning.
Yes, indeed.
Is it over 90? I didn't check the thermostat.
94.
94. Wow. Mm-hmm.
We get to start using that heat index this time of year.
Yeah.
That makes...
Because when it's 94 and you tell people, but it feels like 96, that completely changes your frame of mind.
I was going to wear a jacket, but 96, I'll leave it at home.
All right, let's get right into the movies for this weekend. There are four of them opening up in town, and I'm here to publicly apologize to you because I told you last week that I would meet you at the theater on Tuesday night for the screening, the press screening of Now You See Me 2. And that afternoon, I texted you and said, something's come up. I can't make it tonight.
Yeah.
The thing that came up was me realizing I hated Now You See Me 1 and could not sit through Now You See Me 2.
Okay.
Now, you did go to the screening.
Yeah.
Did I make the correct choice?
Yeah. It's not... It's
Colin
not,
felt it was his duty, though, to tell
it's
you
not
that.
That's what he's paid for.
Yes.
Yeah. Yep. Hazard Pay was probably in line this week with the two movies that I have got.
Okay.
So we'll start with Now You See Me 2. Now You See Me was a pleasant box office surprise. They didn't anticipate a ton of money. And if you never saw the first one...
Don't.
Well, actually, I'm going to say it's worth a DVD rental. This is... It's probably better.
If you have nothing else in your Netflix queue, still don't get Now You See Me.
Yeah, see, I don't know that it's that bad.
It was one of my worst movies of the year.
Yeah, but I don't know that it's that bad. It's a perfectly harmless little magic thriller. Now, one of the things we agreed on in the first one is if you're going to have magicians, have them do magic, and it just evolved into CGI.
Yeah.
You couldn't possibly do these things.
And now here are these amazing magicians who will do things that they couldn't actually do if we didn't have these computer-generated special effects.
Yeah, so that's frustrating, and I will tell you, they didn't get away from that. And let's be honest, there's a reason why. Jesse Eisenberg is the lead in this, along with Dave Franco, Woody Harrelson, and now we've got Mark Ruffalo and Lizzie Kaplan round out the...
Lizzie Kaplan, who's so good on the Showtime series Masters of Sex.
Yes.
But in this movie, she takes the place that was formerly played by Isla Fisher.
Yes.
Who people remember from Wedding Crashers.
Mm-hmm. She left, and they explain it with like one sentence. And this, you know, they just sort of say...
Is Lizzie Kaplan playing the same character that Isla Fisher played?
No, she's a new character.
Okay.
She's new.
But it doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it doesn't really. In the first one, these four magicians come together to form something called the Four Horsemen, and they stage a series of Robin Hood-ish type...
Stunts.
Yeah, thefts to help people who are down on their luck.
I don't remember everything about the first movie, but wasn't there part of it that they sucked the money out of a bank's vault through a tunnel that went through the earth?
That was the trick. That's what they were telling everyone they were doing. Yes. But it wasn't that, because it's magic. Yep. And so I rewatched the first one this weekend.
Little giggle there?
Yeah. I rewatched the first one over the weekend just so I'd be...
Oh,
fresh.
You did? Okay.
Yeah, fresh on everything.
Sorry to hear that.
So this movie picks up about a year after the first movie ended. Our four horsemen are now in hiding because they're fugitives.
Yes.
They robbed people.
Yeah.
And even if they were doing good things with the money, it doesn't matter. Well, they are now part of an organization, a secret magic cabal known as the Eye. And I was actually kind of excited to see where they took this, because I'm like, oh, this will be neat if we sort of see these other magicians. And
Sammy Davis Jr. founded that organization.
Yeah, I think Vice President Sandy Duncan had something to do with
it.
Yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
Hey, babe, thank you, cats. I've got an eye on you.
What happened to your voice?
I don't know. I was eating a cookie.
So they're part of this organization now called The Eye. And I'm like, oh, this could be interesting. We'll see, hopefully, behind this. And this is where the movie makes its biggest misstep. It gets too involved in the mythology of this group and, oh, how do they work? And are they helping us? Are they actually here to help us? And And it fails there because we don't know anything about it. And you can't speak to us as if we do. You sort of lose us off the bat. And that's a major misstep because you're left wondering, did I miss something? The answer is no, you didn't miss anything. They just didn't tell us. And that's kind of frustrating. Well, and
I'm confused about the plot. Well, that's because we didn't explain it to you. Oh, okay. Go ahead.
And if you saw Ocean's 12, you may remember the way that that works is... the person that they stole from in the first one now says, you need to steal from someone else to get me back my money.
Mm-hmm.
This may have been called Now You See Me 12, because that's essentially what we have happening here.
Was that Michael Caine?
Michael Caine was in the first one.
Yeah.
Daniel Radcliffe is the heavy in the second one.
Okay.
He's the bad guy. And so they have to, you know, they've got to steal something, and they use their magic skills to, of course, help steal something. And, mm-hmm. and then there's a turn, and they've got to use their magic skills to stop this again. It's all centered around magic that couldn't possibly be done, which is a little frustrating.
Mm-hmm.
It's not awful. It's just the large problems are the mythology. It just gets sort of bogged down in that. And... you can see, for a movie that's supposed to be magic, where there's misdirection is central to it, and you don't know how they did it, you can see every twist in this movie coming from a mile away.
Well, that's not good when you're supposed to be performing magic and you can see the trick being done.
Yeah, that's frustrating. I didn't do a lot of reading about this intentionally beforehand. I wanted to be surprised.
Mm-hmm.
They set this up at the end of, I'm just going to tell you, it's not spoiling anything, but I think the last words in the movie might be, so what are we going to do next? I got home and found out Now You See Me 3 is already in the works.
Oh.
So we're continuing on with this.
Is this going to make money at the box office?
Man, I hope not. It's not going to repeat the success of the first one. The first one wasn't particularly well reviewed, but it was charming and fun. This is worse reviewed. It's a worse movie.
The only movies that really get away with, well, we'll see what happens to the adventure in our next movie. The only ones that really pulled it off in modern times, as far as I'm concerned, are either a Bond movie where it's mm-hmm. Bond will be back in 2019 in whatever, or
the superhero movies,
the Marvel movies,
yeah. And also the Back to the Future movies.
Yeah.
Remember, the first one ended, and and now we go back to the future until the new movie comes out, and then Back to the Future 2, and then after 2, they made that absolutely lousy Back to the Future 3.
And Back to the Future 4, they went back and unmade Back to the Future 3.
Right. So,
world in which it never existed.
So telling people that you're going to be back with that next movie.
Yeah, it's just...
after you've made a bad second movie?
Yeah, it's... That's frustrating. I will say this movie does no favors to a few people. Morgan Freeman, who returns.
Yes.
Who
must have caught Robert De Niro disease. He must have run out of money repeatedly. How many times can you possibly go broke and need to do trash like this?
I don't know. But he does it again. And Jesse Eisenberg, this is probably the most damaging to him. People think he's a good actor because of what he did in The Social Network.
Mm-hmm.
I'm now firmly in the camp that Jesse Eisenberg, after Batman vs. Superman this year, in which they told us he was supposed to be Lex Luthor, but I don't know what he was.
No, I don't either.
He's a bad actor. I'm just going to say it. He's bad. Mm-hmm. He's legitimately a very bad actor.
Well, I don't know if he's a bad actor.
No, he's a bad actor.
Or a one-note actor.
Nope, he's bad. He doesn't even play that one note well. Okay. He's just bad at this point. I'm off the Jesse Eisenberg train.
Okay.
He's got to do a lot to win me back. He's bad.
All right.
And he's bad in this.
Okay.
And I'm done with him.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm just frustrated because this is probably going to do the most damage to his career.
I know. I have not seen this movie, Now You mm-hmm. See Me 2, but I heard
mm-hmm.
that Woody Harrelson plays mm-hmm. identical twins.
Yep. They have different hairstyles, so you can tell them apart.
Well, of course they do.
And one of them has a vaguely effeminate voice, because isn't that funny in 1996? And I feel bad for him. I like Woody Harrelson.
Yeah.
I think he's a charming guy. I think he's goofy in real life. And mm-hmm. I buy the Woody Harrelson package.
One of those guys who effectively turned himself from a TV character actor into a movie star, a legitimate movie star.
Yeah. And, you know, I mean, Woody Harrelson is sort of Teflon at this point. He could be in the worst movies, but you're going to be like, I like Woody Harrelson.
Right.
If you like him, you're going to be like, I'm going to cut him some slack.
Even if he's bad, you can go, well, he's no Jesse Eisenberg.
Oh, who's just awful.
All right. A scale of 10, what do you give Now You See Me 2?
I give it 4 because it's got points that are fun enough that it sort of makes up for the really bad stuff.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so don't go see it, because try to convince them not to see the third one. Wait for it on DVD, but man.
What's it going
to
do at the box office?
Now you don't see me.
Yeah, hopefully. Yeah. There's going to be so many puns. Wait to read all the, and now you don't see me.
Now you shouldn't see me.
The vanishing act that should have been, Now You See Me Too, should never have been made. There's going to be 1,000 silly movie review puns like that.
If they could really do magic, they'd turn this turd into gold.
They can't pull a rabbit out of the hat for a second time. Now You See Me Too falls flat.
Pen and don't tell anyone.
Movie too long. It should have been cut in half. Yeah just all these horrible magic puns. It's going to do above, it's going to do north of 20, probably, but it's not 20 million this weekend, but it is not going to overtake the movie I didn't see this weekend.
Okay, and that is?
I did not see The Conjuring 2.
Another sequel.
Yes, sort of the third in a line.
Wait, how can it be the third if it's called Conjuring 2?
Because we had The Conjuring.
Mm-hmm.
That was good.
Mm-hmm.
Go rent The Conjuring. I really enjoy it. And then it had a spinoff slash prequel called Annabelle that was about the creepy doll from The Conjuring. And that was last year, I want to say. Maybe 2014. Well, I can't remember off the top of my head. And that was fine-ish. It wasn't great. It was fine-ish.
Okay.
And in The Conjuring 2, they take their... It centers around a husband and wife, Lorraine and Ed Warren, who now travel to their sort of... paranormal investigators, and they slash I think they can do exorcisms or disenchant evil things.
This is supposed to be based on a true story, correct?
No joke. I actually think Ed and Lorraine Warren are real. Mm-hmm. Like,
wow.
Conjuring,
I think so.
Yeah. Conjuring is legit based on a real story.
3 years, Colin's been doing the movie reviews on this show, and every Friday there's some movie where Dan says, is this based on a true story? Because it's a superhero movie or a goofy spy movie. Is this based on a true story? First time!
I know, but I saw that on the trailers, too, that this movie's based on a true story, which intrigues me.
And by that, they mean London is a real place. That's what it's based on.
What?
So this takes place north of London, and they're there to investigate something.
Okay.
Yes.
Neither one of us saw it, so we can't review it. But
no,
that'll be the box office winner.
Yeah, probably, because it was a relatively small budget, and it's going to make money. And it's got good. It's got sort of good mojo. The first two movies in this were very good and good enough. Why not? You go back to the original formula, see if it's good.
What about the other big movie that, well, I don't know if it's going to be big, but another video game movie that's opening called Warcraft, which I assume is based on World of Warcraft?
Yeah. Well, actually, Warcraft, the first game that's, I don't know. There have been about 12 games and expansions.
This is Warcraft. Before it got to World of Warcraft. It was it was Village of Warcraft.
There you go.
Actually, it was a neighbor. It was Village of Warcraft Heights. East Warcraft Heights.
Just Warcraft and Warcraft 2. They sort of take the premise of the first two, inspiration from the first two video games, and mash it up into one. And if you haven't played the video games,
you have no reason to see the movie
whatsoever. Because you're going to be like, wait, why orcs? What are these? And humans and Azeroth and the Seven Kingdoms? I don't understand. And I don't get their names. Like, you have to have a working knowledge to care about, like, Mediv.
I'm sorry?
Exactly. Mediv. You're going to think people are sneezing throughout the movie because of the names.
Dan, here's your cue.
Is this a true story?
No. We're back. Start a new streak.
All right.
Goldan, yeah. You're not going to know what's going on. Oh. And even if you have played the games, they're so old now that you may not be familiar with what happened.
When are they from? I don't even know.
Oh, Warcraft, I want to say, was late 90s.
Okay. Which is forever ago in the world of video games.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And then there was there are literally 12 games or like expansions in the Warcraft world. Mm-hmm. That's a lot.
Okay.
So this movie, for the uninitiated, if you're sitting here and you say, you know what, I've got 2 hours in which I would just like to have my eyeballs tortured, then you might want to go see this. And I'll tell you what it's about then. This movie centers around a world in which humans are here, and there's seven kingdoms, and there's dwarves and elves and all sorts of different magical humanoid creatures. And these orcs are from another dimension, and they come through a portal.
I hate when they come through that portal.
They're from, like, another world, and they come through a portal because they've used a bad type of magic on their home world, and now it's desolate and dying, so they have to go find a new world. And so
did they leave behind a post-utopian dystopia?
Well, they don't even live there. It's a wasteland. It's just a wasteland.
Is it apocalyptic?
No, this is a battle. Yeah.
Is this where Mork and Mindy came from?
Mm-hmm. Gosh.
Orc.
This is where Orc and Indy came from.
Orc and Indy?
Yeah.
Indianapolis?
Yes.
Okay.
It's based in Indianapolis.
Wow.
A post-apocalyptic dystopian Indianapolis.
Yes.
All the orcs moved to Indy.
Oh, Billy Chris is on there.
Hold on a second. Can you turn up Billy Crystal at the Muhammad Ali thing?
But Dick said, okay, I'll try him if he stinks. I can cut him out of the show.
He's telling the story I told earlier.
My first time on television, and it would be with Ali. I arrived at the Plaza Hotel. The event was jammed. I met Mr. Schaap, who would later become a part of my family. And he said, well, how should I introduce you? Nobody knows who you are. And I said, just say one of Ali's closest and dearest friends. And my thought was, I'll get right to the microphone, go into my Howard Cosell, and I'll be fine. And then I nervously move into the jammed ballroom, and that's when I saw him for the first time in person. It's very hard to describe how much he meant to me. You had to live in his time. It's great to look at clips, and it's amazing that we have them, but to live in his time, watching his fights, experiencing the genius of his talent was absolutely extraordinary. Every one of his fights was an aura of a Super Bowl. He did things nobody would do. He predicted the round that he would knock somebody out in, and then he would do it! He was funny. He was beautiful. He was the most perfect athlete you ever saw, and those were his own words. But he was so much more than a fighter as time went on. With Bobby Kennedy gone, Martin Luther King gone, Malcolm X gone, who was there to relate to when Vietnam exploded in our face? There were millions of young men my age, eligible for the draft for a war that we didn't believe in. All of us huddled on the conveyor belt that was rapidly feeding the war machine. But it was Ali who stood up for us by standing up for himself. And after he was stripped of the title, and the right to fight anywhere in the world, he gave speeches at colleges and on television that totally reached me. He seemed as comfortable talking to kings and queens as the lost and unrequited. He never lost his sense of humor, even as he lost everything else. He was always himself, willing to give up everything for what he believed in. And his passionate rhetoric about the life and plight of black people in our country resonated strongly in my house. I grew up in a house that was dedicated to civil rights. My father was a producer of jazz concerts in New York City and was one of the first to integrate bands in the 40s and 50s. Jazz musicians referred to my dad as the Branch Rickey of jazz. Yeah, yeah. My uncle and my family, Jewish people, produced Strange Fruit, Billie Holiday's classic song describing the lynching of African Americans in this country. And so I felt him. And now there he was, just a few feet from me. I couldn't stop looking at him. And he seemed to, like, glow. And he was, like, in slow motion, his amazing face, smiling and laughing. I was seated a few seats from him on the dais. And in the room, all of these athletes in their individual sports, great ones. Gino Marchetti of the Baltimore Colts, Franco Harris of the Steelers, Archie Griffin, who had won the Heisman from Ohio State, literary legends, Neil Simon, George Plimpton, all on the dais, fawning over Ali, who then looked at me with an expression that seemed to say, what is Joel Grey doing here? Mr. Schaap introduced me as one of Ali's closest and dearest friends. Two people clapped. My wife and the agent. I rose. Ali's still staring at me. I passed right behind him, got to the podium, went right into the Kosel. Hello, everyone. Howard Kosel coming to you live from Zaire. Some would pronounce it Zaire. They're wrong. It got big laughs. And then I went into the Ali. Everybody's talking about George Foreman. I want to talk about George Foreman. George Foreman's ugly. He's just so slow. George was slow. I come on, boop, boop, boop. And then I have a rope-a-dope George, and I'm still fast at 33 years of age. I'm so fast I can turn up the lights, be in my bed before the room gets dark. Howard, I'm announcing tonight that I got new religious beliefs. From now on, I want to be known as Izzy Yiskowitz. I'm an Orthodox Jew. Izzy Yiskowitz, I am the greatest of all time. The audience exploded. See, no one had ever done him before. And here he was, a white kid from Long Island, imitating the greatest of all time, and he was loving it. And when I was done, he gave me this big bear hug, and he whispered in my ear, "You're my little brother." Which is what he always called me until the last time that I saw him. We were always there for each other. And if he needed me for something, I was there. He came to anything I asked him to do. Most memorable. He was an honorary chairman for a dinner and a very important event where I was being honored by the Hebrew University in Jerusalem. He did all of this promotion for it. He came to the dinner. He sat with my family for the entire evening. He took photographs with everybody. The most famous Muslim man in the world honoring his Jewish friend. And because he was there, we raised a great deal of money, and I was able to use it to endow the university in Jerusalem with something that I told him about. And it was something that he loved the theory of, and it thrives to this day. It's called Peace Through the Performing Arts. It's a theater group where Israeli, Arab, and Palestinian actors, writers, and directors all work together in peace, creating original works of art. And that doesn't happen without him. I had so many funny, unusual moments with him. I sat next to him at Howard Cosell's funeral. A very somber day, to be sure. Closed casket was on the stage. Muhammad and I were sitting somewhere over there next to each other. And he quietly whispered to me, "Little brother, do you think he's wearing his hairpiece?" So I said, I don't think so. Well, then how will God recognize him? So I said, "Champ, once he opens his mouth, God will know." So we started laughing. It was a muffled laugh at first, but then we couldn't contain ourselves. Here we were at a funeral, me with Muhammad Ali laughing like two little kids who heard something dirty in church. You know, we're just laughing and laughing. And then he looked at me and he whispered, "Howard was a good man." One time he asked me if I would like to run with him one morning, do road work with him. I said, "Well, that'd be amazing. Where do you run?" He said, "Well, I run at this country club, and I run on a golf course early in the morning. It's very private. Nobody bothers me. We'll have a great time." And I said, "Champ, I can't run there. The club has a reputation for being restricted." "Well, it's restricted to me. They don't allow Jews there. They don't have any Jewish members." He was incensed. "I'm a black Muslim, and they let me run there. Little brother, I'm never going to run there again." And he didn't. My favorite memory, perhaps, was 1979. He had just retired, and there was a retirement party at the Forum, Los Angeles, for Muhammad and 20,000 of his closest friends in Los Angeles. I performed a piece that I had created. The imitation had grown into a life story. It's called 15 Rounds. And I play him from the age of 18 until he's 36, ready for the rematch with Leon Spinks. I posted it on the internet last week, footage that nobody had ever seen before, of me portraying Ali, doing his life for him, all those years ago in 1979. There were 20,000 people there. But I was doing it only for him. It's one of my favorite performances that I've ever done in my life. I sort of got lost in him. I didn't even know where I was at the end of the performance. And suddenly I'm backstage with another heavyweight champion, Richard Pryor. And Pryor is holding on to me, crying. And then I see Ali coming. And he's got a full head of steam, and he's looking only at me, and he nudged Mr. Pryor aside, and he whispered in my ear with a big bear hug, "Little brother, you made my life better than it was." But didn't he make all of our lives a little bit better than they were? That, my friends, is my history with a man, and I've labored to come up with a way to describe the legend. He was a tremendous bolt of lightning, created by Mother Nature out of thin air, a fantastic combination of power and beauty. We've seen still photographs of lightning bolts at the moment of impact, ferocious in its strength, magnificent in its elegance. And at the moment of impact, it lights up everything around it, so you can see everything clearly. Muhammad Ali struck us in the middle of America's darkest night, in the heart of its most threatening gathering storm. His power toppled the mightiest of foes, and his intense light shined on America. And we were able to see clearly injustice, inequality, poverty, pride, self-realization, courage, laughter, love, joy, and religious freedom for all. Ali forced us to take a look at ourselves. This brash young man who thrilled us, angered us, confused, and challenged us, ultimately became a silent messenger of peace, who taught us that life is best when you build bridges between people, not walls. My friends, only once in 1,000 years or so do we get to hear a Mozart or see a Picasso, read a Shakespeare. Ali was one of them. And yet, at his heart, he was still a kid from Louisville who ran with the gods and walked with the crippled and smiled at the foolishness of it all. He is gone, but he will never die. He was my big brother. Thank you.
Wow.
Pretty good.
Wow. That was awesome.
Yep. Billy Crystal at the Muhammad Ali Memorial in Louisville, Kentucky, live here on the Big 550 KTRS. We'll take a break and come back with more right after this. The Friday edition of the Large Morning Show in the afternoon on the Big 550 KTRS. I'm Paul Harris, Dan Strauss, Ian Geis, Colin Jeffrey, all here in the studio with me this afternoon. We're talking about showbiz stuff. Just heard Billy Crystal do a phenomenal eulogy for Muhammad Ali in Louisville, Kentucky. And the movies that we've been talking about here today, I think you gave a 4 to Now You See Me 2, 4 mm-hmm. out of 10. And the other one you saw was Warcraft.
What 2 out of 10. It's boring, and the only thing that saves it are some good visuals.
Do you know anything about the other movie that's opening in St. Louis today, which I think will be on just a few screens, and that's called Maggie's Plan? Have you heard of this? Do you know anything about it?
Maggie's Plan didn't even show up on my list, so no, sorry.
I don't know anything about it either.
Sorry.
David Letterman sat down for an interview with Tom Brokaw that is going to air this Sunday night on NBC. 6 o'clock Sunday night on the Channel 5 slot opposite 60 Minutes being on Channel 4. And have you seen the clip?
I saw Letterman with that big old beard.
Big old Santa Claus beard.
Yeah.
I can tell you, I've had a beard for 3.5 decades. I try to keep it neatly trimmed. I always did. For a while, when I was much younger, it would be a little bit bushy, but I could never do like a ZZ Top kind of beard.
Oh, he almost looks a little like Joe Thornton from the Sharks.
Yeah.
Got that crap going.
Yeah. You know, in the last few years, a lot of guys in Major League Baseball, too, have grown. Wasn't it Jason Mott?
Yeah,
the first one who had that big bushy beard on the Cardinal. I could never do that. You know why? And Ian, you've got a close crop beard, and Colin too.
I
get to a certain point, and it just
I don't want the whiskers going up my nostrils.
Yeah,
as soon as that starts, that's just too irritating. And down in front, how many people have you seen who have how many guys have you seen who have that big sloppy beard? I'm not talking about like a well groomed ZZ Top,
the scraggly one.
I'm talking about the scraggly one that's bushy. Everywhere, yeah. And they smoke, so there's cigarette stains on the whiskers.
I've seen a couple of women like that, too.
There's food stuck in there and all of that sort of stuff. At least Letterman's is neat, but it does look like a giant bushy Santa Claus beard.
Yeah.
So he sat down with Tom Brokaw, and I just want to play you a minute of the interview that's going to air on Sunday night on Channel 5.
Do you miss every night?
No, I don't. And it's interesting. I thought for sure I would. And then the first day of Stephen's show, when he went on the air, an energy left me, and I felt like, you know, that's not my problem anymore. And I've kind of felt that way ever since. I devoted so much time to the damage of other aspects of my life. Concentrated, fixated, focusing on that. It's good now to not have that. I couldn't care less about late night television. I'm happy for the guys, men and women. There should be more women. And I don't know why they didn't give my show to a woman. That would have been fine. I'm happy for their success, and they're doing things I couldn't do, so that's great.
Did they ask you about who should replace you?
No. Oh, no. Yeah. No, they didn't ask me about anything. They were just happy I was going.
That's Letterman with Tom Brokaw. It'll air Sunday night.
Hey, we got a free game
slot.
Yeah, right at the end there.
Wow.
Here's two things about that little segment of him talking about that. When he says, I would watch it, and I go, well, it's not my problem. And he also says, I couldn't care less about late night TV. I guess he didn't watch the last 5 or 6 years of his own show because that attitude became apparent on the air.
Yeah.
I mean, the show looked like he came in 30 seconds before the show was going to start. They handed him a piece of paper and said, here's on the show tonight. Boom! And Paul Schaefer rolled into the opening theme. He even said he wasn't involved in booking the guests. He wasn't involved in anything that happened on the show. He was just there to do the show. And it was really, really apparent for anybody who watched him. So,
you know, we all phone in those jobs where you get paid $22 million a year.
We do it here.
Yeah. I'm not taking that kind of a pay cut. What, are you crazy?
I guess I'll go into work.
I couldn't care less about this. And So it's interesting. I said this last year when he did his last show and all the tributes were being paid to him. And the same is going to be true now after this interview airs on Sunday night and people get nostalgic for Letterman. Name one thing he did since the year 2000 on any TV show that was memorable enough for you to name it.
Joaquin Phoenix interview.
He
that
didn't do
awful
that.
Train wreck of
he,
an interview.
Yeah, but he didn't do that.
Yeah, but it was from a show. And I think of that immediately.
One. We got
the
one.
The 9/11 tribute. You said since 2000. So the 9/11 tribute he gave.
Okay, two.
That's not... You said zero.
Now
I gave you two.
Now, but ask anybody to name stuff from the old NBC show and all the innovation he did on
that.
No,
that's all my favorite memories of that show.
Yeah.
Monkey Cam and him doing things on the street.
Larry Bud Melman.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Throwing the watermelons. He did that.
Rupert Deli. Chris, all that stuff he stopped.
Chris Elliott came up from
the
seats.
Oh, he was a man on
the
street. Regular guest. Yeah.
All that stuff. That's the era. Maybe you could name some things from before 2006 or 7.
Stupid human tricks.
But not many of them.
He wore athletic socks with dress shoes all the time. I remember that. There you go.
Yeah, that was innovative and really changed late night television, and I can't wait to go through the YouTube montage of that.
Yeah.
Well, how long ago was it that he threw a pencil through the fake windows?
Yeah.
I mean,
that probably when the show stopped being funny to me.
Right. But people have nostalgia for him, and it was mostly about that stuff. Whereas the Carson legend, which ended in 1992, went right up to the end. He was still doing innovative, clever, funny, and admirable television right to the end of his 30 years. Whereas, you know, Letterman, he broke Carson's record, but doesn't...
He just kind of stopped.
Yeah, he stopped doing the show.
Yeah.
Long before he stopped doing the show.
And Carson is now on... What is that?
Antenna TV.
I love watching those old Carson shows.
I wish AT&T U-verse would carry it.
Yeah.
We don't have Antenna TV.
Oh, man. I've been watching.
Is that on Charter?
Yeah.
Is that how you get it?
Yeah, it is. Yeah.
I bet it's fantastic to go back and watch those things.
Oh, it is. And to see some of the... He had... and they do it like when Muhammad Ali died. They had Ali on the show.
Oh,
with
see,
Carson
that's good programming.
Yeah,
right there.
They do that. Yeah.
All right. That's our showbiz stuff for this week on the Big 550 KTRS.